and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is May 30th, 2026, and this is episode 610. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York State. You are listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe to our show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd and support the show, please. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Southern Italy. How's your allergies doing? Are they worse than mine or are mine worse than yours? I don't know.
Well, we'll have to arm wrestle about it sometime. And you'll win that anyway. But I feel kind of cheery these days or this day because my nasal passages, according to what the doctor said after he inserted one of those flexible little probes with a light on the end of it.
Yeah.
Up my nasal passages, which is amazingly hard to sit still for, by the way. He said, you know, you got a lot of nasal clogging, but it's no big deal. And I was actually really pleased for that because I've had some scary symptoms and like loss of balance is one of them. I mean, even more than my usual native klutziness.
From the inner ear?
Yeah. But apparently it's nothing clinical, really. And I also read a ghost-written memoir by Danny Trejo, the hero of a lot of grim-looking Westerns, like, I think, Runaway Train and Machete and Once Upon a Time in Mexico and all that.
He spent some time in San Quentin, right? Or so he said.
A lot of time.
Okay.
Yeah, he was, I think, the middleweight champion of San Quentin.
Uh-huh, okay. And didn't he say he met Charlie Manson there?
Yeah, he met Manson because...
Or in a different jail, maybe, I guess.
No, it was up there. Mm-hmm. And he met Manson because, well, to put it bluntly, Manson was afraid of being raped by the black faction in the prison. And the Mexican faction took him in, and he specialized in letting them hallucinate that they were shooting up when they were out of heroin, because they were all heroin addicts. And he would dramatize this process of getting the needle, heating it up, going through all those lethal disease-creating stages
rituals,
that you have to go through.
Yeah. That sounds like it sounds like it's worth reading the memoir.
It is. It's very good. Yeah. It's often very funny as well. The ghostwriter, and I don't know how much is Trejo and how much is the ghostwriter. You never do. Mm-hmm. But ghostwriter is another recovering addict, and people like that tend to do good comedy at considerable price.
Yeah. Yeah, if they survive it, they
got some good stories.
Yeah, plenty to describe. All right, well, let's get to the big stories. Speaking of stories, and you know, it will always have to begin anyway with the Iran war or the suspended Iran war, for which there is still no agreed upon deal. I don't know if you were watching this last week, John, but especially if you're on something like Twitter, I mean, just the Barak Ravid like factor. Barak Ravid is that Axios reporter who had been an IDF intelligence officer and who is he's basically just a pass through for different people in the Trump and Netanyahu administrations. And he's doing this nonstop, you know, breaking, deal about to happen, breaking, right. deal almost done, breaking. All that, requires is Trump signing it. Everyone's agreed on the details over and over. This has been going on since, what was it, April 8th, when hostilities first ceased, or the open hostilities. And, you know, I think as we've been saying all along, even actually before they came to the kind of first quasi-ceasefire that we're in right now, that it's very, very hard for Trump in particular to come to a ceasefire deal, a real full agreement, because Iran won and yep. Iran's conditions for making this a permanent, in quotes, because nothing's really permanent with Trump, and they know that. But whatever, a more permanent deal, Iran's conditions, because it is in such a stronger place now, are incredibly humiliating for Trump and the U.S. empire, and will lead to a situation that is damaging to Trump politically, and is a real humiliation for U.S. power, because U.S. power is going to be, and it'll be sort of like, making official, putting ink to paper, the situation that we're already in. And the third big problem is Israel. Israel is already sullen and angry about this. They know they dragged, well, they don't know anything. They did help drag Trump into this.
If I can interpolate one thing, they dragged him in for a ridiculous reason, which is they swear they had it all ready for the Kurds to go in there and wipe out the Iranian armed forces. First of all, the Kurds could not wipe out the Iranian armed forces.
Yes.
Not in a million years. And second, the Kurds, I would hope, have finally gotten tired of being everybody's cat's paw in the Middle East. And it would be a disaster for them to do anything like that, if only because of the Turkish revenge, which would be god-awful, and which Israel and probably the U.S. would do nothing at all to ameliorate. So for once, either they or someone in the U.S. or even Trump himself had some sense and stopped them. They were 1 second from doing it, blah, blah, yeah. blah. But that's an old story. And I'm just glad they didn't do it, because I am kind of sentimental about the Kurds after a year in Soleimani, and it would be a grim thing to see thousands more killed.
I think the Kurds themselves, the most likely explanation, and there's so much propaganda and bullshit being thrown at us about what the Iranian Kurdish groups were willing to do with at least a faction of the Iraqi Kurdish Kurds. And this goes to the very beginning of this, but the latest, what I've seen from sources that I've found a lot more credible, was that the Iranian Kurdish groups were not stupid. They weren't going to go in. They were given a lot of weapons. They maybe even sort of said, we'll do. But they wanted to wait and see what really happened, because they live there. They're in that region, and their cousins and family members are inside the border, even if we're talking about Iranian Kurdish military
groups.
A lot of
them are under the ground from previous attempts, like the one when the U.S. attacked Saddam, and the Kurds believed that we were going to save them. We, as in the U.S. Armed Services. And were slaughtered. I mean, Catherine and I took a tour of the museum in Halabja. Mm-hmm. And Halabja, if people remember, is the rather sizable town, Kurdish town, in Iraqi Kurdistan, that was bombed with chemical shells by the Iraqi army, and thousands of civilians were killed in a few minutes. And why would you risk that again?
Yeah. And those precursors for those chemical weapons were very knowingly sold to and given to the Iraqis with know-how from Donald Rumsfeld, from the Americans, from the Germans, and others in the West. And we were giving Saddam intelligence the entire time to help coordinate chemical weapons attacks. I don't know that we were directly involved in that one in particular, but we're directly involved in developing his chemical weapons program. But yeah, so bad things, how many bad things can happen? I think that the best reporting or that I've seen says that the Iranian Kurdish groups in Iraq were not ready to go in and be slaughtered for Trump and Netanyahu. That and eventually Trump started, he's been complaining, you know, we gave the Kurds a lot of guns, a lot of weapons, they kept them, this is not good, not right. So he's been complaining. But
Trump got the Trump treatment for once. I mean,
yes,
go Kurds. That's all I can say to that.
But the Israelis leaked to or sort of helped plant this story. If you know how these things work in Al Monitor, it's a Middle Eastern news site, has good articles, good reporting at times. And this article, very much massaged by the Israelis, basically says it's Mossad trying to cover their ass, because Mossad and the Israelis told Trump that the Kurds will rise up, the Kurds will be the boots on the ground, the regime, right. All it needs is one kick and it's done. We bomb from the air, they go in from the ground and it's over. And so they've had to answer for it. So now what Mossad is planting, and not just Mossad, but Netanyahu's inner circle. And this was just at the end of, this was just yesterday it was published. So this was clearly timed to pressure Trump, who's getting closer and closer to a humiliating deal with Iran. What this argues is that it was going to work. The Kurds were ready to do it. The whole Israeli plan was on the verge of working, and then Trump got scared, got cold feet, and called the Kurds back in. He, quote, hit the brakes on it, unquote. And they're claiming that Iran is still ripe for a regime change, that it could still just one more kick fall over, because they want to keep at least the pro-Israel lobby, you know, on board. But I don't know. I think this article is very suspect, to put it mildly. Where we're supposedly at with this deal that is 96% done or 98% done or almost 100% done, the ceasefire deal, is that Iran would open up the Strait of Hormuz over a 30-day period. The U.S. would lift its blockade on Iran's blockade, which is causing some economic harm to Iran. They would sort of make official the end of hostilities, or at least for another 60 days. Israel is supposed to stop attacking Lebanon. We can talk about that. Of course, they're not. And the U.S. would have to start lifting some sanctions and unfreeze at least some of the frozen billions of dollars that Iran cannot access because of U.S. sanctions and secondary sanctions. And the part that matters the most to the U.S., which is Iran's nuclear program and its nuclear enriched uranium, that part of the discussion would be put off for another 60 days for a final agreement. So basically, Trump would have waged this war and ended up essentially unfreezing billions of dollars in sanctions to Iran, which for Trump is so humiliating, because his whole campaign against first Obama and then Biden was that Obama and Biden started lifting some of these sanctions on Iran to try to get them to scale back their or open up at least their nuclear program to inspectors. And that meant Iran had access to billions of dollars, which is rightfully theirs. I mean, it's based on you know, sales of oil that the U.S. was able to freeze the revenues that were supposed to go back to Iran. But anyway, Trump and Trump world and the Israel world and the right-wing world, their whole argument was, Biden, you just gave billions of dollars to Iran so that they could make nukes and fund terror groups and kill Israelis. And that was his basic argument. So now he's going to be in the position of unfreezing billions of dollars. And Iran will not do a deal without that. And Trump is going to have to do a deal that includes it. And so he is in, you know, again, he's still in the same pickle. And this is why I think he keeps having such a hard time. I'm sure they probably have been very close to a deal because all sides keep saying they're getting close. But it's Trump who's going to suffer from making this official. I think his base can still be lied to. Like when you watch people from his base and the pro-Israel world, basically his hardcore MAGA base, which is, let's say, 30% of the electorate, they will swallow anything he tells them.
It's really remarkable. Yeah. You see interviews with them, and their bottom line is, well, we've still got a big army and, you know, we'll kill you, is implied.
Yeah, and one of their favorite lines is, Iran is going to have nuclear weapons. Do you want them? I mean, it's just like the Iraq war, right? The WMD threat. Yeah. Iran's going to have nuclear weapons. No president had the courage to try to take it on. Trump is the only one who has, and I have faith he's playing four-dimensional chess that we monkeys can't understand. So that 30%, but most of the country will know that it's a humiliation, and Trump will know it. And kind of importantly, the elite of the MAGA base, which is extremely pro-Israel, which is the influencers and the political class, they're going to go ballistic, and they've already shown that. Like as Trump got close to signing this deal or agreeing to the deal yesterday, you saw Laura Loomer threatening the Loomer Trump, you know, saying, I can't believe Trump is going to make this deal with a terrorist group. You know, all Muslims need to die and whatever the hell whatever crazy shit she says. Mark Levin, you know, Trump has been trying to promote Mark Levin as the sort of MAGA replacement for Tucker because Tucker's anti-Trump now. And Levin was coming out saying, this deal sounds awful. I can't believe this is going to happen. Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, and, you know, more quietly, the Netanyahu government and the whole kind of Zionist infrastructure elite. Like, if and when he agrees to the deal, he's going to get a lot of pushback from a part of that group. So, I don't know. I think it does bother him. It does worry him. I think, as we talked about, you know, before the show, Trump is also looking at signing a deal or going to war. Either way, is destroying his presidency. It's definitely almost for sure. I mean, depending on how badly the Democrats flub it, but almost for sure is going to lead to Congress, at least the lower house, turning Democrat. But I think, as you said, you know, he may not mind that. He doesn't like a lot of these Republicans, which is pretty clear.
Yeah.
He might like having that pushback. I mean, one thing the presidency has dictatorial powers over imperial policy, almost total dictatorial powers. And in any event, the Democrats, as a rule, don't push back on wars. They don't push back on Pentagon budgets. So that's not where the pushback is. It's more on domestic issues where Congress has some more power, and Trump doesn't seem to really give a shit about domestic politics anymore.
Well, he said that. He said, I don't think about people having a hard time with gas prices at all.
Yeah, he's being honest there. So one thing Trump did try doing last week, I don't know if you saw this, is some of his, I thought at first it was, again, almost one of his kind of off-the-cuff jokes, but he really pushed it hard. He basically said Saudis, mainly Saudis, I think Turkey, Pakistan, but he said, you guys need to join the Abraham Accords. And, you know, Iran's ready to make this deal. We're ready to make this deal. But you need to join the Abraham Accords. And if you don't join the Abraham, he basically said, if you don't join the Abraham Accords, which means recognizing Israel and doing like the UAE and Bahrain and becoming fully integrated into the U.S.-Israel system, which would be incredibly politically destabilizing for Saudi Arabia to do that. This is not going to happen after October 7th. It's not in the cards, but it's like Trump. It's a Hail Mary by Trump. So he basically said, if you don't do it, I'm going to be forced to restart the war with Iran. And you know what that means. If I restart the war with Iran, your countries are going to get, well, Saudi, he meant, your country is going to get wiped out. And because we all know what the Iranian, you know, capabilities are. So he's basically weaponizing the Iran threat to try to blackmail the Saudis and Qataris to join the Abraham Accords. And the reason he wants them to join the Abraham Accords so that he can spin whatever deal is going to be such a clear, you know, defeat, but he can spin it as a win by getting them to join the Abraham Accords. He's trying to find some way to spin it. And he's really threatening them. He has already threatened, then he threatened to bomb Oman a couple of days ago.
Yeah, that was weird. Oman, which stays out of everybody's way.
Yeah.
And has a lot of money and is perfectly peaceable and by all accounts has a really nice coastline. It's just like all the vindictive kids in the whole neighborhood just want to gang up on Oman. But, you know, I was thinking that after you said that, I was wondering, what if this was a game of Risk and there was a provision for a five-minute timeout and Trump could just say, okay, listen, Iran, let's carve this thing up together. let's yeah. carve it all up. You take everything to the south there. We'll take everything to the north. That would be really kind of interesting.
Yeah. There was some thought that the reason why he's started to threaten Oman, and then Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, has been threatening to sanction Oman's leaders, is because Oman is taking more seriously, like clearly talking with the Iranians about whatever new system they set up at the Strait of Hormuz. Like Iran initially said they were going to charge a toll as a way of getting compensation for the rebuilding because of all the hundreds of billions of dollars of damage the U.S. and Israel caused. But the toll system is, for a variety of reasons, in fact, I want to get a guest on to talk about all this. Explicitly charging a toll would be problematic. So now they're talking about charging a fee for, like a parks fee almost, because part of the Strait of Hormuz is in Iranian territorial waters, and part of it is in Omani territorial waters. Because
yeah.
Oman has that little exclave sticking right up into the strait. And the Omanis initially said no because they didn't want to step on too many other toes in the Gulf. That's not their way. But now they're kind of seeing that this may be a way, a part of a settlement. And you charge like an environmental protection fee or something like this, whatever, to get everything moving again. And there's been talk that Trump may be thinking about working with the UAE to invade that exclave, take it over, and then Trump and Iran share the toll fees.
Yeah. But then,
like, so to your point, like the people have been kind of floating that as a Trumpian possibility. Although, you know, that would require, I don't see that actually happening. But
no, I don't either, but
I'm sure they talked about it.
Yeah. For once, there's somebody, some kind of mind there that just has no morality at all and no allegiance that I can see to anyone. And they might just come up with a solution out of left field.
Yeah, maybe. So in the meantime, you know, just in the last 24 hours, just before we recorded the show, actually, it was reported that, so earlier in the week, you know, the U.S. and Iran were sort of trading fire a bit. Things started to heat up The U.S. bombed a bunch of apparently like missile launcher sites on the Iranian coast in the Gulf and a few speedboats. And the U.S. claimed we did it in, quote, they were self-defense measures, defending ourselves 5,000 miles away by bombing Iran. And just last night, Iran fired a Fateh, at least one anyway, Fateh 110 ballistic missile at the U.S. airbase in Kuwait, Ali al-Salem. And initially reports were that it was shot down, nothing happened. But Bloomberg just reported before we recorded the show that actually, well, it clearly hit the base because at least five U.S. service people were injured, but perhaps more as importantly, I guess, two MQ-9 Reapers were destroyed. And that's got to bring, it must be up to about 40 MQ-9 Reapers that have been, if I'm not by now, destroyed between the Yemenis and the Iranians. And that's like, it's hard to get a real hard figure on how many MQ-9 Reapers the U.S. military itself has, but it could be about roughly a third of the Reapers are now gone.
I don't know the exact fraction, but a whole hell of a lot of the sub-launched and surface-launched Tomahawk missiles are gone as well. And that was, as I said at the time, simply out of cowardice to avoid casualties. You go in with a non-piloted vehicle instead of a plane, which is more expensive and not as automated. But the U.S. is burning through resources in a pretty insane way.
Absolutely. Yeah, also the JASSM-ER, the standoff munitions, the depletion rate of those, of these missiles and munitions has been incredible. And also, of course, the interceptors, the THAAD defense missiles, the Patriot PAC-3 defense missiles. There's a report that just came out, I think it was Associated Press, that tallied this up again. It's not the first one to do this, but basically the U.S. military won't be anywhere near back up to where it was, let's say, you know, in February, let alone perhaps last year, because of all of the missiles expended, both to protect Israel and to protect its own assets. Not until roughly like 2029. That's
so
a long
time. So if everybody
can
hold off any attack plans they have.
Exactly.
Until then.
And that's why it's hard to imagine that the U.S. can go back to war. I mean, war is the other option. And it's always a possibility, and it's not like the U.S. can't wage war. It's just that it can't successfully wage war, and it can't wage war without taking a lot of casualties. And I think that's what this ballistic missile firing is. It was a demonstration, a hard demonstration again.
Yeah.
As far as I know, they might have only fired one Fateh 110 yesterday. One of these ballistic missiles.
Well, but they might still have been lying about the amount of damage that was done.
Exactly.
Because there's been an awful lot of lying.
Absolutely.
From Israel, from the U.S. bases in the Gulf as a whole. A lot of lying. And you can tell that they were shocked by the, as they say, vigor of the Iranian response because they wouldn't admit it. They wouldn't admit it did damage.
Yeah, well, and they also, for the first time ever, forced commercial satellite imagery companies to stop beaming satellite imagery from that area. So OSINT went down. So there was no OSINT that we could use except for whatever the Chinese and the Iranians would leak. But I want to make a point again. I mean, yeah, to your point, look, the Iranians also took out very expensive, very, very expensive and very crucial THAAD radar systems, various radar systems, basically the eyes, intelligence eyes, high-tech eyes of the U.S. military to protect its bases. So the fact that if it was just one missile, and it's a pretty standard ballistic missile, it's a short-range missile, the Fateh 110, one missile fired and one missile did all that damage, at that airbase. I'm surprised. I thought, you know, I know that the Americans cleared out a lot of service people from these bases. They're able to injure or kill, we might find out, some servicemen there. Suggests that, again, they had good intelligence and the U.S. can't defend anymore.
I mean, putting up your troops at a Quality Inn for the weekend, even if you get a big troop discount, is not really a good idea.
Yeah, I would have thought they pulled them out after all of this. But this is a demonstration, a hard demonstration, unlike the ones that Iran did before February 28th, where they tried to make sure nobody got hurt. They don't do that anymore.
No.
They demonstrated again that, God, I mean, again, this is a lower down missile in the Iranian arsenal, and it just got hit this key, I think it's the largest U.S. airbase in Kuwait. And they hit service people and valuable, reapers. So that should be a hard reminder, you would think, to Trump and Hegseth, that if they try to restart this war, to try to get a better deal, it's going to go almost for sure a lot worse. We've also had all kinds of articles about how the Iranians have basically completely reconstituted their missile and drone production facilities, that whatever launchers and launch sites and mountains that were kind of caved in from bombs dropped by the U.S. have already been unburied and are back in service. Like, it didn't work. It's just that simple. It did not work. And now all that we're waiting for is for Trump to put ink to paper to that, to formalize reality. And it's going to be painful and it's going to be ugly. And for that reason,
well, if
it's
what
dangerous.
You say is true and he can't do it, that is, his own vanity prevents him from doing it. Trump's own vanity is quite a little obstacle.
Yeah, no, it is.
It's sort of like, why don't we just vaporize the mountains along the Strait of Hormuz? Well, because, you know, they're big old mountains.
There is a constraint. I mean, if you ask me, I think Trump would like to keep the situation as it is right now. He sells it to his base and the kind of the Israel lobby and all these people. He sells the current situation as a victory. And you'll see all kinds of people, idiots, so on. But people with power and clout and so on, arguing that right now, as it stands, the U.S. is in a victory because we've got the Iranians blockaded in and they're suffering so badly and their economy is going to collapse any day now, any minute now. So they're still arguing this. The constraint is this, that, and we don't know when it's going to happen. It's been a surprise to me, but at some point, and it supposedly is going to happen very soon, all of this oil that cannot reach market because it's stuck inside the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, all of the ways that we've been able to use to keep markets from, from basically to prevent a shortage, which has been releasing strategic oil reserves. The Chinese have cut back on how much they're importing a lot. We don't know the whole reasons why, but that has helped out. The constraints are going to hit very soon where the shortage just means a shortage, and that's it.
Yeah.
So you're going to start having lines at gas stations. You're going to see the price of oil spike. Now, this was supposed to happen already. So, the funny thing about markets is you never know exactly when this is going to happen. It's hit in different developing countries. I think there have even been sort of like gasoline riots in Eastern Africa and I think Kenya and some other areas. Some Asian countries have been hit hard by it. Like poor countries have been hit hard by losing like liquefied petroleum or liquefied oil, cooking oil, jet fuel. Jet fuel spiked and there was a shortage, but It's come down some, again, against what experts initially thought. But what I will say is both the heads of, I think it was the COO or something of Exxon, and then the CEO of Chevron, this last week came out and said, a shortage is a shortage. And we've had all these different ways of kind of filling in for it over the past couple of months. But in the first or second week of June, it's just mathematics. There's no way to cover for it anymore. So if there isn't a deal that opens up the strait, and even if there is a deal, because it takes a long time, once the strait is, it's not just a switch that it turns on and everything is normal immediately again. It's going to be, I mean, the futures markets may come down, the oil futures markets, but I think we're looking almost for sure at some kind of shortages in the short term, but it'll get really acute if no deal is done, according to them. So, you know, the oil majors, these are people that have Trump's ear. Trump loves their extraction.
Yeah, and I think they have sort of been softening the blow for him as much as they can.
Yeah, but they're saying now, like, there has to be a deal in the first week or two of June, or there are physical shortages. Oil per barrel goes up to 150 to 200. And you'll have a shortages so severe that you'll cause a contraction in the economy because there's no other way to lower demand. Basically, there'll be a global recession, which will lower demand for oil, which will make it affordable again. So that's the kind of shit Trump's looking at. So he can't stay in this kind of fake interim situation, this kind of suspended animation, neither peace nor war. He can't stay here indefinitely, though he would probably like to. And the only way to get out of it, again, is to either restart the war, which makes everything worse, or do a peace deal, which is humiliating to him, humiliating to the empire, terrible for Israel. You're already seeing signs of Israel turning against Trump if he does do it. Just even leaking that report that it was Trump who chickened out. Trump did a taco on the Kurds, and it's supposedly his fault. They're going to pillory Trump over it. So he's kind of screwed either way, but he's going to have to pull the proverbial trigger. Moving on, sticking again with Israel. There was just a report yesterday that Israel, behind the scenes, has been trying to pressure Trump to assassinate Iran's lead negotiator, Mohammad Ghalibaf, who's kind of the face of Iran these days, the Iranian parliamentary speaker.
I mean, I can just see some fussy mid-level State Department official like, that's your answer to everything.
Yeah, no kidding. And the fact that they're not doing it suggests that maybe it has gotten through to whatever's left of Trump's brain that listening to Netanyahu has not done him very good. And speaking of Israel, Netanyahu came out yesterday and said Israel is preparing now to take 70% of Gaza. I think so. When they signed the ceasefire with Hamas, they had already claimed something like 53% of Gaza, which is already incredibly small and overcrowded enough as it is, even after the genocide's not done. And meanwhile, aside from taking more of Gaza, Netanyahu has expanded the IDF's war invasion into Lebanon. They already had previously announced they were taking everything up to the Litani River, but now they've announced that they're expanding it to beyond the Zahrani River, which is 40 kilometers north of the border of the Israel border, about 25 miles. And it includes the city of Tyre, the fifth largest city in Lebanon, which has a population of roughly 200,000 people, and they're busy bombing and cleansing that as well. And again, it's because Hezbollah, when we talked to Cyrus, you know, we talked about how when they were devastated by Israel in late 2024, they reconstituted themselves more closer to their original form as a guerrilla group primarily. And you're seeing that play out since March 2nd, since Israel invaded Lebanon on March 2nd. And now they've adopted this drone technologies that have been really kind of evolved very quickly in the Ukraine war, and particularly the fiber optic first-person video drones. Hezbollah, you've seen just in the last couple months how quickly their drone capabilities, their skills have really improved, and their intelligence has improved. They're taking out Iron Dome batteries left and right, if you've seen those, John.
I have seen. Yeah, the Iron Dome batteries are just, in the shots I've seen, like firing posts on an old-fashioned wall. And there's an area that's left open so that the images could come back. And they go right down the back of those firing posts and just blow the hell out of them.
Yeah. And they clearly have really good intelligence. They're using drones for intelligence and human intelligence. And the funny thing is,
I haven't read any stories that directly analyze the Ukraine links, but there has been so much gloating over Ukrainian technological superiority over Russia in, say, the NYT or something like that. You're going to have to adjust that quite a bit.
To
handle this.
Yeah, I think it was Ali Abunima who was a guest on our show. He pointed out the difference in headlines when you talk about drones. So with Ukraine, it's, you know, these kind of cheery headlines, Ukraine drone technology really turning the tide. And then with Hezbollah, it's Hezbollah's drones threaten, the drone threat from Hezbollah. Like suddenly they're a threatening technology. I mean, you've seen they're, Hezbollah is getting so much better so quickly. You see FPV drones now, like instead of kind of bombing anywhere on a piece of armor, they're hunting around for an opening in like an APC or some kind of troop carrier, and then going right into the back with when the, you know, waiting for when the door is open. And the last image you see is like a two IDF soldiers kind of trying to sprint away and about three others stuck inside.
There was one guy that made a really good jump off the Merkava.
Because legend.
He saw at the last moment that a little FPV was going to hit it.
Yeah,
I don't know if he made it, but it was a damn good try.
Yeah, also, and this has gotten a lot of play online, Hezbollah took out this very, very overweight IDF officer, woman officer, who would post TikTok videos of her kind of doing gloat dances in occupied Lebanon. And it was announced that she was killed by one of the FPV drones, and people have been having fun with that. And, you know, as they say, FAFO, fuck around, find out. So Israel's plan, though, is just to keep moving deeper in. And I think the idea is that they make it harder for the drones to at least cross the border, because especially with FPV fiber optic drones, they have a range. Well, it depends which level the Hezbollah has. I mean, they have a range usually from anywhere from 10 kilometers to 40 kilometers. You know, all this means is more is IDF soldiers for Hezbollah to hit.
Right. And I think the IDF also has this goal of finding the FPV HQ, you know, Mr. Big theory. And maybe they'll do it, or maybe they'll hit a couple of HQs, because I'm sure there are many more. You don't need much more ability than a kid who could stay awake for a long time and knows how to do little drone technology. And once again, it doesn't really seem like a realistic strategy. Like, you may attrit, as they say, as well as equipment, but you're not going to destroy enough of it.
It's too DIY. This is something developed by the Ukrainians and then by the Russians as well. I mean, the production of these drones is just too DIY. There is kind of one constraint is on the fiber optic cable. I know that at least in the Ukraine-Russia war, both sides, the price of fiber optic cable has gone up a lot because there's such demand for it.
Right.
So it's a little bit harder to come by. But the drones, the parts of the drones, the battery, everything is just, I don't think, you know, fine, you get one little garage taken out, but there's a million other garages that are producing these. The other thing is that at least if we take the Ukraine war as an example, like what's happened in the Ukraine war, and it explains the weird, this would be maybe for another episode, but the kind of the weird, as they call it, the gray zone. Shout out to Max Blumenthal, but this large gray zone in the Ukraine war kind of front area. And it's very wide. It's 10, 15 kilometers wide, let's say. And at any time, Ukrainians or Russians can claim that, and it's never really controlled by either one. And what happens is, in that war, even with these large populations, what they've eventually learned is you put like a little FPV drone team, or, you know, drone teams, you hide them, seed them in different areas in the gray zone, and they can stop any kind of mass movement, or, you know, make it too painful for any mass movement, and also see any mass movement that right. maybe is going to try and take territory. So then what the other side does, I mean, the Russians kind of pioneered some of this. So the Russians sort of pioneered these really small infiltration groups. So instead of trying to take a town or take some territory with the usual, you know, armor and infantry and so on, you just send in a bunch of different teams of two or three infiltrators, and you go hunting for the drone operators on the other side.
Oh, yeah.
And you use your drones, your ISR drones, your intelligence drones, high up in the sky to try to find where you think they might be. And then you send these infiltrator groups in, and it's very hard then for the drone operators. Let's say we're talking the Ukrainians are the drone operators, the Russians are the infiltrators. It's harder to find these, you know, teams of two or three, much harder. And you might even get one of those guys or two of them, but there's like four other teams coming in from various directions. And those guys get taken out.
God damn, what a video game that would make.
It is, exactly, I know. And the Israelis are just so behind on this, you know, they've not been studying. I guess it takes a while to change doctrine and tactics. But what they're doing is like a 1980s style or 90s style Israeli punishment invasion, right? Which would work with different munitions. If you're fighting against Hezbollah firing, you know, RPGs or small rockets
right.
into northern Israel. But all they're doing is creating a whole bunch of sitting ducks for drone operators. I mean, so I don't know if we'll see the Israelis start to change their tactics to try to take them out. I don't, you know, it's not satisfying for the Israelis. I don't think it's been satisfying for the Russians either. You want to bomb and punish, and because so much of Israeli doctrine and strategy is about dominance and demonstrating dominance and crushing. It's about dominance, right? They think
right.
that they must dominate the Arabs is how they would scream about it. And so it's hard to imagine that they would. It's kind of humiliating having to send in teams of two or three on scooters or motorcycles or, you know, the way the Russians have kind of done it and the Ukrainians. I just I don't know if
yeah.
or when the Israelis will adopt that. But in the meantime, I think Hezbollah is just going to cause the IDF a lot of pain. But that at the same time, it's going to hurt Netanyahu at the polls. But I think we've seen, you know, as Cyrus has said and others, that Israeli society has become so fascistized for lack of a better word, that they are still clearly able to take the casualties. That it is not, right. It's not causing, that's not causing political problems. What's causing political problems is failing to dominate, is not bombing properly. And that, I think, is what might hurt Netanyahu. And it would be great, even though you know that Netanyahu will be replaced by somebody equally horrible or worse, it still would be great to see Netanyahu in the dock, even if it's just for bribery.
You know. And on that happy note.
Yeah, on that happy, hopeful note, I think we can end this episode. Thank you again, John, Brendan, and all of our subscribers, and talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.